Chapter 10. Campion was doing a bad job of masking his fear. It was in the tightness of the muscles around his mouth, in the set of his jaw, leaking through his eyes and pores. "What's wrong?" I said, slurred as a drunkard. "I was going to whisk over to you, not the other way around." But before he had a chance to answer, Silverwings told me herself, whispering information into my head. Our two ships had run into the Gentian emergency signal, an event sufficiently ominous that both vehicles had taken the decision to awaken their occupants. We were still travelling at maximum speed, still more than a dozen years from our destination. "I came out first," Campion said, "the advantage of just being in stasis." "I don't like stasis," I said testily, although of course he knew this. He helped me out of the upright box of my cryophagus casket and gathered me in his strong warm arms. I felt cold and fragile, like a flower that had been dipped in liquid nitrogen, something that might shatter into colourful brittle pieces at the least provocation. "How are you feeling?" Campion whispered into my ear, nuzzling his face against mine. "As if I want to go back to sleep again. As if I'd really prefer if this was just a bad dream."
"Silverwings pulled you out fast because of the emergency. You're going to be a bit groggy."
I pulled myself tighter against him. He felt fixed and solid, an anchor I could tie myself to. Hesperus, who was standing behind Campion, said, "You have been apart for some time. If you wish to copulate, I can retire to another part of the ship or simply disable my attentive faculties for an agreed interval."
I did not want to copulate. I just wanted to hold Campion tightly and let life seep back into my bones and muscles and nerve fibers. But Silverwings was still speaking into my skull.
"The embedded content," I asked. "What did it say?"
Campion pulled back a twitch. "What embedded content?"
"You didn't look."
"It's a distress code, that's all. There isn't meant to be any embedded content."
"Silverwings says there is. Maybe Dalliance didn't pick up on that, but it's there."
"That's not protocol. We're supposed to connect to the private network. Find out what the storm's all about."
Something's obviously changed. More exasperated than cross, I said, "I can't believe you missed the content, Campion. What would have happened if I hadn't been around?" Then I grimaced. "Ignore me. It's just brain chemistry."
"Shall I retire while you examine the message?" Hesperus asked tactfully. I shook my head. "Whatever this is, we're all in it now, including our guests. You'd better brace yourself for some bad news. Whatever this is about, it could mean a delay in reuniting you with your friends."
"Thank you for thinking of my welfare when you must have so much else on your minds. With your permission, I would consider it a privilege to be privy to the embedded content. May we examine it here?"
"I think I need a drink first," Campion said, eyeing me guardedly. I felt the same, torn between wanting to know the news, however bad it might be, and at the same time wanting to do anything to delay the moment of revelation.
"We'll take it on the bridge," I said, closing the door of my casket.
"There's something else you need to know," Campion said to me quietly, while we were on our way to the nearest whisking point.
I squeezed his hand and asked, "What?"
"We're down a passenger."
My brain was still mush. "One of the sleepers we picked up from Ateshka?"
"No, it's Dr. Minnix. We won't be having the pleasure of his company again."
"What?" I asked again, aware of Hesperus only a few paces behind.
"He died. His casket broke down. Hesperus says he tried to fix it when he saw something was going wrong, but Dr. Minnix had put in too many safeguards."
Campion had put emphasis on that "says," letting me know he only had our guest's word concerning what had really happened.
"My God!"
"Any other time it would be the only thing on my mind, but now that this has happened as well..." Campion trailed off. "I can't say I'm going to miss the old bigot, but..."
"You'd still rather he hadn't died. Yes, that's sort of how I feel. They're going to lap this up, aren't they?"
"Give them half a chance. But if it wasn't really your fault..."
Some impulse caused me to glance back at Hesperus, though I was doing all in my power not to act awkwardly.
"He says he didn't do it," Campion said under his breath, "for now I've decided to take him at his word."
As we whisked through ship to Silverwing's bridge, my thoughts veered between anxious anticipation of the embedded content and dark speculation as to Hesperus's innocence. I was still prickly and tense when the bridge lit up in welcome as we entered. Anticipating our arrival, the ship had arranged 3 seats around the plinthed glass hemispheres that was the main displayer. Although Silverwings could have swallowed Campion's little ship 50 times over, what passed for a bridge on my own ship was about 1/20 the size of his, with configurable walls that were always set to a dull pewter, a low, dimpled ceiling griddled with lights, and only the very minimum in terms of visible instrumentation and control interfaces. "I presume you were serious about that drink," I said, pausing at the bridge's maker while it fashioned and filled 2 glasses. Campion's was alcoholic, mine a cocktail of neural restoratives to assist my recovery from the cryophagus. Campion took the glass. "Thank you." I indicated to Hesperus that he should take the sturdiest seat, while Campion and I lowered ourselves into the other 2. "No point in delaying this any longer, is there?" I asked, with a nervous catch in my voice. "State the nature of the embedded content, Silver, for everyone's benefit." The ship spoke aloud. "The embedded content is a non-interactive audio-visual recording with a playback time of 135 seconds. If there are deeper content layers, I cannot detect them. Can we assume it's safe?" "I have scrutinized the message to the limit of my abilities and found no dangerous patterns." I ran my tongue along the dry edge of my lip. "You'd better run it, then. Ready, everyone?"
"As I'll ever be," Campion said.
He chose that moment to reach around for my hand, our fingertips only just touching. The upper half of a man appeared in the hemisphere, rendered life-size. It only took me a moment to recognize him as a fellow Shatterling of Gentian line, and to put a name to the face.
"Fescue," I said softly.
"What would he want?"
Campion began, before Fescue spoke over his words.
"If you are in receipt of this message, then I'm assuming that you are latecomers for the reunion. Ordinarily you would deserve the sternest censure, but these are not ordinary times. Now you deserve our blessing, our thanks, and above all our heartfelt wishes for your own continued survival. You may be all that is left of Gentian line." The imaged figure nodded gravely, leaving us in no doubt that we had understood his words. It was definitely Fescue, but not as we usually knew him. The haughty, supercilious demeanor was only visible as a ghost of itself. His face was drawn, his hair disheveled, clinging to his forehead in damp curls, his eyes weary, frightened slits. There was even something on his cheek that looked like a burn or bruise or a smudge of oily dirt.
"We were ambushed," he continued, prolonging the syllables of the word with lingering distaste. "The 1,000 nights were yet to begin. 12 or so ships were still to arrive, even though we had already been waiting more than 15 years. Hundreds had already come, of course, more than 800 in orbit. Most of us were already on the world, awake in the carnival cities or waiting in abeyance for the celebrations to commence. When the weapons opened fire, we had no practical defense. The world's impassors were too feeble to counter the assault, and our ships were annihilated before they could aggregate into an effective counterforce. They used homunculus weapons against us, horrors we hardly dare speak of, exhumed from the deepest, most pathological vaults of history. After they had reduced our ship to clouds of ionized gas, even the largest and strongest of them, they turned on the reunion world and pumped energy into it for 100 hours. It was a business of minutes, a mere preamble, to boil away the atmosphere and oceans and render that world as sterile as it had been before our arrival. But the attackers didn't stop there. They continued to pour energy into the planet, melting first the crust and then the mantle, turning the entire world into a molten ball that glowed first orange and then furious gold, until it began to break up, its own gravity insufficient to hold it together. Over 4.5 days, the energy output of those weapons exceeded even that of the sun the world orbited, and when they were done, nothing remained. That was 8 years ago, by my reckoning. Still more time will have passed when you intercept this signal.
Concentrate your senses on the target system, and you will soon see not a sun and its family of worlds, but a new nebula, a roiling dark cloud of rubble and dust and tortured gas, now bound only by the gravity well of the star itself. It will endure for centuries, thousands of years, significant fractions of a circuit. Planets and moons plough through that cloud, but not the world we hoped to make our temporary home. It's gone, and so has most of the line. Fescue paused and stroked a finger against a puffiness under one of his slitted eyes. It occurred to me then, as it had not before, that he might very well be blind. At no point had I sensed his attention focused in any particular direction. "Some got out," he said. "Those with the fastest ships, the best camouflage or countermeasures, but few were so fortunate. It will come as no surprise to hear that I have initiated the Belladonna Protocol. You must deviate immediately from your present heading. Under no circumstances attempt to enter or approach the reunion system, for even now, 8 years after the ambush, the aggressive elements are still loitering, waiting to pick off latecomers. Even once you have obeyed the Belladonna Protocol, you must be watchful for pursuers. Complete your turn stealthily, and use misdirection as appropriate. If you sense you are being followed, you must sacrifice yourselves rather than lead the attackers to the Belladonna fallback." Again Fescue fell silent, looking to one side as if he had seen, or perhaps heard, something that merited his attention. When he resumed speaking, it was with a renewed haste. "I chose to embed this message because it was too risky to convey this information via the private network. The nature of the ambush implies that our security is not as tight as we had imagined, and any attempt to tap into the network may be detected and acted upon by those who would seek to exterminate our line. Concerning the nature of our attackers and their reasons for doing this, I regret to tell you that I have no information." Fescue shook his head forcefully. "Nothing, not even the tiniest flicker of intelligence, but I know this. Unless one has arisen in the last circuit, no galactic civilization, not even the rebirthers or the machine people, is known to possess the sophistry and vacuum manipulation necessary to duplicate homunculus-level technology. Those weapons must therefore be the original instruments, despite the fact that Marcelin Line was charged with their disposal 4.5 million years ago. The question therefore begs itself, did Marcelin Line betray their promise to the commonality and conceal those weapons when they should have decommissioned them? I cannot believe they would have done so, but then neither can I believe that Gentian Line has enemies who would wish this upon us. Therefore tread carefully, for if the Marcelins cannot necessarily be trusted, then neither can any other line in the commonality. After 32 circuits and 6 million years, we may finally have run out of friends." Fescue halted, and for a moment it appeared that he was done. Then he raised his chin, striking a defiant pose, and said, "I wish I knew how many of you were out there. I would like to think that there are still latecomers on their way home, but for all I know, attrition may already have taken every last one of you. I will say this, though, in the vain hope that it reaches some remnants of the line. Now you and a handful of survivors carry the candle that Abigail set aflame. That is a singular responsibility, a greater burden than you have ever been required to shoulder. You must not let the rest of us down." Fescue bowed his head. The image froze and then flicked back to its starting position, ready for the speech to be replayed. We watched it again, in case there was some nuance that had escaped us the first time. When our messenger was done, Campion said, "This can't be real. Someone's faked it. Someone's figured out how to send an emergency signal impersonating Fescue." "Why would anyone do that?" I asked. There was a coldness growing inside me, a realization that our future had just become stranger and more frightening than it had appeared only a few minutes ago, but for now I was still capable of reasoned thought. "To get at us, of course, to give us a reason to skip the reunion completely. God knows we've got enough enemies, enough people who'd love to see us miss the boat." "They wouldn't dare use Fescue's name unless they had his authority. He sent this message, or delegated it to someone he trusted." "Fescue hates us. He's got every reason in the world to trick us with something like this." "And risk excommunication? If he sent this signal via omnidirectional broadcast, then it'll have been intercepted by every shatterling who hadn't yet made it to the reunion.
Fescue might have an axe to grind against us, but he's not vindictive, and he definitely isn't stupid.
I cleared my throat. I've been thinking all this through as well, you know. I'd love to believe this is a hoax, aimed solely at us. But that's not how it looks to me. I think this is real. I think something horrible has happened, and we're being warned to get as far away from the reunion as we can.
That would also be my conclusion, Hesperus said.
Did anyone ask you? Campion snapped.
My apologies. I should not have spoken. No, I said, you should have, because you're right. This is real, and we have to take it seriously. Listen to Hesperus, Campion. He has every reason to want to make it to that reunion. It's where we've promised him he'll find other machine people. And now that message is saying the party's off, and Hesperus still believes it. Doesn't that tell you something?
Campion spread his hands before his face, as if he wished to bury it in them. I can't deal with this. It's got to be some kind of mistake, something blown out of all proportion.
Or it's exactly what Fescue said it was, an actual ambush with huge losses.
We'll know soon enough in any case. Now that we've a reason to, we can concentrate our sensors on the system ahead. With two ships, we can establish an observational baseline wide enough to resolve the nebula, if it's really there.
It may be easier than that, Hesperus said. If the system is now dust-cloaked, the spectral properties of the star will be modified. It will appear redder, and contain the absorption lines characteristic of the elements making up the planet.
Silver, I said hesitantly, because I knew I was on the verge of having a harrowing possibility confirmed. Tell me if there's anything unusual about the target star, compared against the trove.
It did not take long. Silverwings informed us that the star was indeed redder than expected, and that its atmosphere contained unusually strong spectral signatures of nickel and iron, proving that the sun was shrouded in the rubble that had once been our reunion world. Furthermore, even at our present distance of 13 lights, there was clear evidence of the nebula, a warm, glowing ellipse like a thumbprint pressed over the hard point of the star. That was when we knew for sure that we were not being hoaxed, and that everything was going to be different from now on. The first 6 million years had been all fun and games. Now we were growing up.
What if there are survivors still hiding out in the cloud? Campion asked. Don't we owe it to them to have a closer look?
Fescue said it was already 8 years since the attack when he made the transmission. Add another 13 years for the signal to reach us, that's 21 years. Add another 13 before we arrive, that's 34 years.
Fescue survived for 8 years, or he wouldn't have been able to send that signal.
He didn't say he was still there. The message's apparent point of origin tells us nothing. It could have been relayed from a ship on its way to the fallback.
Read between the lines. He was hurt. If he was anywhere else other than inside the system, he'd have been able to get himself fixed. His ship must have been damaged, and chances are it was still inside the cloud. Fescue must have been hiding there ever since the attack. That means we have to consider the possibility of other survivors. His voice notched higher. If we were down in that system, crippled but still alive, we'd be counting on outside help as well.
The survival of the line outweighs the survival of individual shatterlings.
Ask yourself what Fescue would have done,
Campion said quietly.
What?
Put yourself in Fescue's shoes. As if he was the one running into this transmission, not us. As if we sent it, and he was the one who had to decide how to act. Fescue was right to warn us, but he knew damned well we wouldn't listen. I might not care for that arrogant, hypocritical asshole, but do you think he'd have been very likely to listen? I don't even know if I'm proposing the right thing, or something worse than stupid, but I know we can't just dismiss it out of hand. These are our brothers and sisters, our fellow shatterlings. They're pieces of us, pieces of what we are, pieces of what make us human. If we abandon them, we may as well forget about the line. We don't have any right to call ourselves Gentian anymore.
We went to see the doctor. The tank was as dark as ever, but now there was something bulging against the glass from within, revealed in flattened, pale islands interrupted by rivers and inlets of random shadow. I looked at it for a few numb moments, trying to work out how that pale, doughy mass could have been introduced into the tank without Dr. Mennings becoming aware of it. Then I made out the flattened, ruptured oval of something that had once been an eye, and it dawned on me, slowly and then with increasing conviction, that the pale mass was Dr. Menink's, and that he had bloated to at least twice his previous volume, until he could expand no more. I scrambled up the ladder to the top of the tank. I folded back the hinged section of walkway and began to twist the circular hatchway. I spun it free and began to lever it back, but I had only opened it a crack when I was assaulted by a noxious, vinegary stench. I slammed the hatch back down. "Tell me what happened."
"I cannot say," Hesperus replied.
My hands trembling, I lowered myself down the side of the tank, back on to the safety of the floor. I had never really liked Dr. Menink, and I had liked him less and less as his true prejudices bubbled to the surface, but he had been a fellow starfarer, a being who had travelled far, swam in oceans of memory and experience, and now all that memory and experience were gone. The anger hit me with the cold force of a supernova shockwave. "What do you mean you cannot say? You are fucking awake, Hesperus. You were the only one he had anything to fear from, the only one he thought might want to kill him, and now he's dead." Hesperus stood at the entrance to the chamber, his arms at his sides, his head lowered slightly, like a schoolboy summoned for punishment. "I understand your reaction, Purslane, but as I have already explained to Campion, this was not my doing."
"Why didn't you try to help him?" Campion asked.
"I did, despite your request that I keep away from him. When I detected signs that Dr. Menink's tank chemistry was amiss, signs that, I stress, were by no means compellingly obvious, I attempted to adjust the equipment in such a way as to remedy the perceived imbalance. I soon discovered that the equipment was not amenable to outside interference."
I was still not ready to let go of my suspicion, but I wanted to hear the rest of his defense.
"And?" "I discovered that by merely tampering with the equipment, I had raised Dr. Menink from his drug-induced slumber. Upon his return to partial consciousness, I attempted to explain the nature of his predicament. Unfortunately, Dr. Menink refused to believe that my intentions were anything other than improper. He urged me to desist tampering with his tank at the earliest opportunity."
"Did you?"
"Of course not. I persisted, despite Dr. Menink's far from lucid protestations. Yet as I attempted to assist him, the doctor succeeded in activating certain devices built into his tank, the purpose of which was to deter outside interference. These countermeasures, though posing no serious threat to my own existence, nonetheless made it prohibitively difficult for me to access the very mechanisms I sought to examine and adjust. With regret, I was forced to abandon my efforts. I could not save the doctor, but merely witness his inevitable decline. It was at this point that I attempted to raise you from abeyance without success."
"And then?"
"I made a number of subsequent attempts both to reason with the doctor and to repair the chemical imbalance, but on all such occasions I was forced to retreat. Eventually there came a day when the doctor appeared insensate, and shortly afterwards I concluded that he was dead. Other than monitoring the integrity of the tank, in case it should rupture and spill the contents into your ship, I have had nothing more to do with the personage."
"Open and shut, in other words," Campion said.
"I can only speak the truth," Hesperus replied.
He was with us when we ran the Belladonna algorithm. We were looking at a portion of the Milky Way, writ large on Campion's displayer. The viewer had already zoomed in on Dalliance's position, with only 1,000 lights or so visible in any direction, about the thickness of the disk itself. The red line that marked Dalliance's future course was arrowing out towards the extremities of the galaxy. A cone projected ahead of the ship, indicating the algorithm's search volume. "It requires us to search in the direction of the galactic anticenter," I said. "We look along a radial line extending away from the core that passes through the position of the reunion system. As it happens, that's pretty close to our present heading."
"The volume will encompass the system you were already approaching," said Hesperus. "Will that not lead to an ambiguity?"
"Belladonna explicitly instructs us to ignore the reunion system and any suitable systems lying closer to the galactic center," I said. "It obliges us to look beyond, until we find a star of the right spectral type, and with the right formation of planets. It must lie at least 50 years from the designated reunion world to give us a chance of getting there without being tracked. Any closer and we could be followed too easily.
There has to be a rocky world in a circular orbit at a suitable distance from the star.
The world must be life-supporting?
Not necessarily, but it shouldn't be so inhospitable that it could never be escaped. We could easily spend several thousand years in the vicinity of the fallback. That's long enough to modify a climate, even to shift a borderline case to true habitability.
And if the world is already occupied?
Then we'll be guests of whoever owns the place. Most civilizations know enough about the lines not to turn them down in their hour of need.
And if they should turn you down?
It's not something you do twice. After a moment, Campion said, "Looks like we have a candidate." The image zoomed in again, dizzyingly, on a solitary yellow star. It was 90 lights beyond the reunion system, practically on its doorstep in galactic terms, but safely beyond the proscribed margin of 50 lights. Provided we did not head there directly, but went off in a false direction before steering back towards it once we were out of detection range, we would be able to reach the system without being followed. I digested the trove data, scrolling down next to the star. The summary was, in all likelihood, no more than the last layer of virgin ice on a mountain of data known to Gentian line. Given the perceptual bottlenecks of the human central nervous system, there might be more known about this world than could ever be absorbed in a normal lifetime.
"Naomi," said Campion, stroking his chin. "Rings a bell, although I suppose there are thousands of Naomis out there."
"No, I'm getting it as well, and I think the memory's specific to this sector. One of us must have been there. Not you or I, or it would come through stronger. It must have been quite a few circuits ago, enough for the place to have changed a bit." According to the trove, the planet had seen many native civilizations. No one was listed as living there now, but that was no guarantee that we would find the world unoccupied. The trove's last update on the matter was 12 kilo years stale.
"The world touches a chord of familiarity with me as well," Hesperus said.
"You've been to Naomi?" I asked.
"Not been, I think. Nothing in my bones tells me I have walked that soil, but I may have intended to go there as part of my wider explorations."
"There's something on Naomi called the Spirit of the Air," Campion said, reading a few lines further down the summary. "Some kind of post-human machine intelligence, I think, although it's all a bit vague. Any chance you were interested in that?"
"You mean as one machine to another?"
"You tell me."
Campion was still suspicious of Hesperus, even though we had agreed to give him the benefit of the doubt where Dr. Menninx was concerned.
"It is certainly possible. It is also possible that I am quite mistaken about Naomi. As you say, there may be other worlds with that name."
"I guess you'll know when we get there," I said.
"One can but hope," Hesperus said. "Of course, there is the small matter of the ambush to deal with first. I wonder if I might be of assistance in that regard."
"We can't trust him," Campion said, lying against me. "Even if we wanted to trust him, it'd be the wrong thing to do."
"He's offered to help us. I've told him I'll let him pick a ship from my cargo bay, something he can use."
"Could be a ruse."
"You mean he's going to take the ship and never come back?"
"It's a distinct possibility."
"Yes, and so is the possibility that he's telling us the truth."
I propped myself up on one elbow.
"So what if he does leave us? We'll have lost a guest and a ship I probably don't even remember acquiring. Hardly the worst thing we're going to have to deal with."
"I'll remind you of that when he turns his guns on us."
"He's a rational sentient Campion, not a vengeance-crazed psychopath."
I ran a finger through the fine hair of his chest, across his belly and down to his sleeping penis. We had been lying together in a warm post-coital haze, until I made the mistake of starting a conversation. The mad one was Dr. Menninx. Hesperus just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
"So he says."
"Do you actually believe he murdered Menninx?"
Campion struggled with his reply.
"No,"
he said eventually. "I think the doctor just took one shortcut too many with his equipment. But I have to act as if I'm taking the matter seriously. I can't appear negligent where the death of a guest is concerned."
"Even when the other guest has volunteered to put his life on the line to help us?"
"Don't make this any harder than it already is. I'm just saying."
Hesperus has some ground to make up. He has to earn my trust again. Earn our trust.
I caressed him until he began to show faint signs of life. He's earned mine already. You're the one who needs to catch up, Campion.
Hesperus ran a golden hand along the golden flank of the little spacecraft he had found tucked in one corner of the enormous room. It was scarcely larger than a whale, more a trinket than a ship.
"It's called Vespertine," I said. "That's about all I remember. I think someone may have given it to me as a gift. I can't recall the last time I had to use a shuttle to move between vessels rather than just whisking over. Been a while since I dealt with an entry-level civilization."
"This is more than a shuttle," Hesperus said, still stroking the little ship's skin.
"What are we dealing with, then?"
"A true interstellar vehicle, Purslane. I believe that the lateral bulge conceals part of a small parametric engine, or something employing similar principles." I shrugged. "Doesn't change much. There are other interstellar ships in here. I keep them for trade."
We were in Silverwing's main storage cargo bay, in the aft third of my ship. The bay was a rectangular pressurized space 8 kilometers long, 3 across and nearly 2 in height. We had entered through the cliff-like edifice of the forward wall, and followed a series of suspended walkways through the chamber, winding between the many ships and ship-sized artifacts that formed my private collection. They loomed huge, most of them cloaked in shadow or darkness, except for the odd clean or ragged edge, a smooth or imbricated surface, limned by the cold blue radiance of the distant ceiling-mounted spotlights. Lately I spent as little time as possible in the main bay. The clutter of the place, the disordered collection of ships and artifacts, was an uncomfortable reminder of the disorder in my head. My skull was a pressure cooker, crammed with too much history. They both needed sorting out, but the longer I put off either task, the less enthusiasm I had. Campion had always been less sentimental than me. He could ditch ancient treasure or submit to memory consolidation without a moment's hesitation. He moved through life with less baggage, less to weigh him down, less to anchor him to his own history. I had always admired him for that willingness to discard his own past, while knowing it was one of the things that made us distinct, a bridge I could never cross if I wished to remain Purslane. And I did, of course. Sometimes I thought of Abigail making clay dolls of us, the way a girl might pass a rainy afternoon, with no thought for what would become of those dolls when she sent them into the world. How trivial it must have been for her to adjust the parameters of her personality before pouring a measure of it into each of her shatterlings. Did it cross her mind, even for an instant, that there might be less than joyous consequences? That on some unthinkably distant day, one of her shatterlings would be standing in a vast room, halfway across the galaxy, weighed down with the melancholic sense of being an unwilling curator in some dusty, little-visited museum of her own existence. Hesperus was looking at me, waiting for me to continue. "Shatterlings tend to be hoarders, as you may have noticed. I've never had much use for half the stuff in here, but I can't bring myself to get rid of it. I'd be too worried about throwing away something really vital without realizing it." "I quite understand. But this ship may yet have possibilities. I should like permission to go aboard, if it will not inconvenience you."
Vespertine floated in a weightless cradle just beyond the gravity bubble encompassing the walkway. Hesperus had to lean over the railing to reach its skin. It was ridged with a Byzantine design, mazes and chevrons and interlocked flower-like forms, vanishing down to a fractal haze of microscopic detail that made the edges appear out of focus. I presumed the design served some arcane field-modifying effect, much as the roughened skin of a shark assisted it in swimming.
"Is there something in particular about this ship that interests you?"
"I should like to see if it is functional, and whether it will accept me as a pilot."
"I don't blame you for wanting to leave us, Hesperus."
"Not my intention. I am considering how I may be of practical assistance during the forthcoming encounter."
"But this is just a tiny little minnow."
"Size may well be the issue here, but not in the sense you are implying. A ship as small as this one would be limited in its agility, not by the power output of its engine, but by the strength of its dampening field. But I am not human. Unbalanced forces that would reduce you to red jelly, I am sorry to be so graphic, but it is necessary to make my point,
would register with me only as a mild impediment to free movement.
Being able to move fast isn't going to protect you from everything that might be hiding in that cloud.
My mission must have been evaluated as a high-risk enterprise from the moment I left machine space. I would have gone into it knowing that there would be moments of crisis and uncertainty. In that respect, nothing has changed.
Did Campion show you the structures?
Yes, he did.
As she had refined her observations of the reunion system, Silver Wings had detected bright objects embedded in the cloud. There were huge glowing structures of irregular shape, branching into jagged fingers like frozen lightning bolts. They were shrouded in dust now, difficult to examine, but we would see them up close when we slammed through the cloud. We had no idea what they were. Deep trove searches were continuing, but their presence did nothing to lighten our mood.
They don't worry you? They are certainly puzzling. I may even know what they are on a level of memory I cannot presently access. I also have every confidence that I can steer around them without coming to harm.
Despite everything that had happened, the weight of knowledge bearing down on me, his bravery stirred me. What I said earlier still applies. If you want to leave, you can take any of these ships. I won't hold it against you, and neither will Campion.
I am still in your debt. I have no intention of leaving until that is settled. Now, may I be permitted to examine the ship? If I am to make the best use of it, I may wish to modify some of her control systems. I know there is still time, but the sooner I start, the better.
Campion and I will be going into abeyance shortly. We'll come out when we're closer, about to begin slowdown. I told Silver Wings to release the security binding on the golden ship, allowing Hesperus to board it. Part of the handrail vanished and a portion of the flooring bulged outwards to connect with a baroque doorway that had just formed in the side of the ship. Soft blue light emanated from the interior, highlighting the chromed flanges on the sides of Hesperus's face. He stepped through the blue-lit doorway, one gold machine entering another. After a moment, the doorway rendered itself impassable. It was as if a pane had frosted over with gold leaf, and then vanished back into the baroque patterning of the hull, leaving no trace of its former existence. The railing remade itself. A breeze, caused by a shift in the miniature weather system that inhabited this bay, flicked a hair across my brow. I had not been there for so long that my entrance had disturbed the equilibrium of the captured atmosphere. There are times when you go into abeyance with the weight of the world on your shoulders, and come out with all your problems suddenly diminished. Still there, still meriting your attention, but no longer having the looming stature that they did before. This was not one of those times. I came out of the casket with the same dread feelings that I had had going in. We braked hard and braked sudden, pushing our engines to the limit, until the moment when we began slowdown and dug claws into space-time like cats sliding down a wall, there would have been little or no warning of our imminent arrival. 2% of the speed of light was almost not moving at all by the standards of Gentian line, a speed so imperceptibly slow that it was best measured in kilometers per second, a unit more usually associated with travel in a planetary atmosphere. But it was still much faster than the orbital motion of any of the bodies making up the system, whether they were the remaining planets and moons, or the dust, grit, and tumbling boulders of the shattered planet. Campion had already pulled away to a distance of 2 minutes, 36 million kilometers, beginning his separation many hours ago. Now our two ships were moving along parallel trajectories, like bullets shot from a double-barreled rifle, and would remain so as we slipped through the cloud, piercing it more or less at its widest point, and passing either side of the sun. Both ships would be peering into the surrounding volume, looking for indications of technological activity. Allowing for the effectiveness of our sensors, we should be able to sweep 20% of the cloud with a sensitivity high enough to detect typical ship signatures. There were places to hide, warm knots and eddies in the cloud caused by the to-and-fro influence of the remaining worlds. A ship could hide itself, masked to eyes that worked on gravity and heat. All the while, we would be doing our best not to be seen. That meant no communications unless absolutely necessary. By the time we were deep inside the cloud, there would be too great a chance of a tight beam being scattered in all directions by intervening debris,
rendering our private communications at least detectable by foreign parties, if not decipherable. It also meant using our engines as infrequently as possible, and not raising our impasses to full effectiveness until a collision was imminent. Running dark, in other words, coasting without screens and relying solely on passive sensor methods. I watched Hesperus leave. Before he entered Vespertine, we touched hands. His was very cold, very metallic, but somehow pliant in the way it yielded to my touch. He slipped out of my grasp and retreated through the blue-lit doorway of the golden ship. The doorway formed over and vanished back into the blurred surface of the hull. A humming note rose and stabilized. A few seconds later, the hull blurring intensified, as if I were seeing the golden craft through a veil of tears. Vespertine moved away from the catwalk, slipping free of its force cradle. The railing reformed. I clutched it, watching Hesperus navigate between the much larger and darker vessels filling my hold. Gradually it dwindled to a tiny, fuzzy mote of self-illuminated gold. The bay door had opened wide. Hesperus penetrated the atmosphere curtain and entered open space. He hovered outside for a few seconds before engaging the engine, appearing to blink out of existence as the massive acceleration snatched him away. I watched the door close and then whisked back to the bridge. "Vespertine is loose," I told Campion. His reply came back 4 minutes later. I didn't see a thing, and I was watching very closely. I hope that bodes well, if and when we run into trouble. His image was based on Silverwing's own memories of Campion, not any visual information arriving over the talk beam. It would have been pointless and dangerous to send more data than was strictly necessary. So our exchange consisted only of the words we spoke, accompanied by a few cues for gesture, emphasis, and inflection, rendered back into a convincing simulacrum of speech. An hour passed, and then my ship had something to tell me. "My troves turned something up," I reported to Campion. "The bright structures in the cloud? I think they may confirm another part of Fescue's story. The trove thinks they may be lesions, a kind of residue left over from the use of homunculus weapons. That's not good news, obviously. Not only would it mean we are dealing with H-guns, after all this time, but it also means someone's used them more recently than 34 years ago. Lesions have a decay half-life, even in hard vacuum. They wouldn't last long in this kind of environment." Campion came back. "Agreed. It's not good news. But at least it means someone had a reason to fire those weapons relatively recently. Unless they were just firing them for the hell of it. It could mean they were trying to eliminate survivors still hiding out in the cloud. Or shoot down latecomers who had the chrome-plated balls to come through anyway, despite Fescue's warning." Campion smiled grimly. "There's that as well." Then he glanced aside at a readout. "Dust is starting to thicken, for me at least. I'm going to have to notch up my impasser effectiveness before it gets any worse. Suggest you do likewise." I sent the necessary command to Silverwings. "Raised. Can you still hear me?" The image flickered, crisscrossed with pink and white static lines. "Yes," Campion said, his voice throaty. "You're coming through. I can see your bubble, though. You're beginning to scintillate. It helps that I know exactly where to look, but you're more visible than you were a minute ago." He meant a minute by his reckoning. It was still taking 2 minutes for light to creep between us. I could see Dalliance's impasse flickering on and off as it interdicted incoming matter, though the effort taxed my senses to the limit. I had sometimes chastised him for using such a small ship, but now his size gave him a clear edge over me. The surface area of his bubble was 120 times smaller than that enveloping Silverwings, making it much less likely that he would run into any given piece of debris. 2 hours in, and I could feel the effect of those collisions as well. As the ambient dust thickened, as we pushed deeper and deeper into the cloud of planetary ashes, so Silverwings registered each impact with a tangible jolt as the impasser soaked up the momentum of the incoming particle and then transferred that impulse to the ship via the generators. The dampeners were doing their best to cancel out any shifts in the local gravity, but because they had little warning, they had to cut in sharply, with a perceptible lag between effect and response. I felt like the captain of an ocean-going ship grinding against an iceberg, each jolt the twang of a hull plate being ripped away. "It's rougher than I expected," Campion told me. The scratchiness of his image
and the metallic timbre of his voice, Silverwing's way of telling me that the data transfer was becoming problematic.
It'll smooth out, though, once the impacts start coming in close together enough. That took another hour.
Silverwings was now driving hard into a sleet of debris, and the momentum transfer had become first a drum roll, and then a rumble, and now little more than a faint ever-present vibration. The downside was that the collisions were sapping my speed. I had to engage the engine just to maintain 2% of light, and I could only run the engine in the instance when the impasser was down. Occasionally there was still a large, barely dampened jolt as we ran into something of an order of magnitude bigger than the usual particles, but my nerves had already been shredded about as thoroughly as they could be. 3.5 hours in, we got our first close view of the nearest lesion. It emerged from its cloak of dust like a sliver of bright landscape seen through breaking fog. It was irregular in shape, flattened and straight at one end, curving in the middle, splaying into vast curved fingers at the other. It was aglow with a soft, milky luminescence. It scared the hell out of me. I tightened my grip on the metal of the bridge banister, half expecting that my ship would be forced to swerve violently at any moment. The lesion was orbiting with the general motion of the cloud, obeying the gravitational influence of the star, but there were countless specks of dust moving on their own courses, with their own velocities. Sooner or later, one of those impacts was going to liberate enough energy to send a wave of transformation slamming through the lesion. It was anyone's guess as to what would happen then. The lesion might just vanish, or the energy embodied in it being sucked harmlessly back into the marrow of space-time from whence it had come, or it might explode, liberating, in an instant, enough destructive force to rip the crust off a planet. The safest thing was not to be anywhere near a lesion.
"We should go dark from now on," Campion said. "Too much chance of scatter. I'll signal you when we've passed the sun and the local cloud density has dropped to a safe level again."
Another 5 or 6 hours. It felt like half my lifetime stretching ahead of me. I was a shatterling, mentally programmed to tolerate immense stretches of solitude, but that mental programming had begun to run amok a long time ago. Now I needed another human being close to me just to feel human myself. I could not see Hesperus, but I knew his intended trajectory. He had not been in contact since leaving Silverwings, but that was no cause for concern. He would pass the lesion before either of us, but his small fleet ship seemed unlikely to trigger any undesirable changes in the abnormal structure. I was more concerned about my own passage. It would give the lesion a wider berth, but my field effects would reach further than Vespertine's. Was hundreds of thousands of kilometers of clear space enough to insulate the lesion from the influence of my impasser and engine? The trove offered no reassurance. I do not think I breathed until I was clear, and the last of those curling fingers was falling behind my ship. I had survived, but there were still other lesions ahead of me, lurking deeper in the cloud. I remained tense, still conscious that my survival depended entirely on the safe functioning of my bubble. Were it to fail, Silverwings would be ripped apart in a blinding moment, and I would probably know nothing of it. Every now and then a larger impact served as a reminder that I was running into pebbles and boulders, not merely grains of dust. The second lesion was larger than the first, but further away, and none of our intended trajectories came within 600,000 kilometers of it. It was similar to the first, but with a bifurcation halfway along its curving, spavined length. Its grasping fingers were knobbly and broken-nailed. The more familiar I became with the lesions, the more they began to remind me of antlers, broken off in some titanic contest between animals large enough to bestride a solar system. 6 hours in, I reached my closest approach to the dust-shrouded sun. On the other side, Silverwings began to register a slow and gradual decline in the density of the cloud. It would be some time yet before I could risk signaling Campion. I had just resigned myself to a long wait when he reappeared. "I'm getting something," he said, sounding unsure of himself. "It's a very weak signal, but it's moving independently of the rest of this junk. Could be a ship, I think."
"Is it Gentian?"
"Doesn't look like it so far. The protocols are pretty old." "Then we don't go after it. We're looking for line survivors, not anyone else stupid enough to blunder into this."
"Agreed,"
Campion said. But for all we know, there are Gentian survivors who don't have the means to send the right kind of signal if their ship's damaged or they had to hide out aboard another one.
I wish you weren't so good at coming up with get-out clauses, Campion.
Silverwings was still seeing nothing, but then Dalliance might have been close enough to sniff out a signal just below my detection threshold. As his ship exchanged data with mine, I confirmed that this was the case. The object, whatever it was, would pass just within Campion's effective center envelope, but slip past mine completely.
All right. I agree that this is worth looking at, but please be careful. We ignored one warning from Fescue. Now we're taking a risk we would have considered unacceptable a few hours ago.
We're flexible, Campion said. It's the price we pay for being sentient. I'm veering. See you in a while.
Hesperus was the next to get in touch. I see Campion moving now, Purslane. He is strobing his bubble to effect a course change. Has something happened?
It bothered me that Campion's actions were so visible, but nothing could be done about that.
He's picked up something. He thinks it could be a signal, maybe from survivors.
It could also be something a great deal less welcome.
Yes, I said tersely. He's aware of that. He still feels obliged to investigate.
If you have no objections, I shall strive to follow Campion and locate the same signal. It will mean sacrificing a degree of stealth, but anyone monitoring this system is surely aware of our arrival by now.
Take care. Please.
I shall.
If you are able, would you be so kind as to inform Campion of my intentions? I would not wish to startle him.
I'll do that, Hesperus, and thank you. I didn't mean to snap just now.
Under the circumstances, I think you may be forgiven.
He closed the link and left me alone. I called Campion, telling him that Hesperus was on his way but that he should not acknowledge my transmission. The last thing I wanted was to feel alone, but the less we talked, the better. I had been scared before, too many times to remember, but there had always been a mitigating factor to take the edge off my fears. I had always been able to console myself with the thought that, if I survived, I would have an astonishing adventure to braid into my strand, something that would guarantee a day or two of dreamy celebrity, even if I had no interest whatsoever in winning the 1,000 knights. And even if I should die in such a way that my strand never reached the line, I would still be commemorated. When the fact of my death was certain, plans would be laid for a commemoration of my life, something to weigh against 6 million years of existence. They might etch my face across the surface of a planet, or blow an image of me into the gas of a nebula, or even shape a supernova remnant into my likeness. It had all been done before. And at the next reunion, and the one after that, all the way down the line until attrition wore us down to the last living shatterling, the last pale memory of Abigail Gentian, there would be an evening during the 1,000 nights when I would be honored as if I still walked amongst the living. I would be dreamed into life again, if only until morning. But now there would be no more 1,000 nights, never another reunion. Some of us might have survived, those of us who had arrived late, but we would never feel safe enough to stage another gathering. The best that we could do, to safeguard the memories we already carried, would be to go off in different directions and find somewhere to hide, living like hermits until time wore our enemies to dust. The fact was, in this hour when I most had need of that consolation, it offered me nothing.